Hello and welcome to a new episode of the Footpole Podcast. I'm one of your co-hosts, Guy Burton, and I'm joined by my other co-host, Francesco Belcastro. How are you doing, Francesco?
I'm all right, Guy. How are you?
Yeah, not bad, actually. Looking forward to the topic that we're speaking about this week. So we're talking about Portuguese football, and to do that, we've been joined by Miguel Lourenço Pereira, who's a Portuguese journalist, and and he's going to be telling us about his new book, which is based on Portuguese football. So Miguel, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Hi, Guy. Hi, Francesco. Very happy to be here chatting in with you about the book, about Portuguese football, and that thing that passionate's all about, the relationship between football and society in general.
Yeah, well, thank you for taking the time to come and join us. And before we start, I just want to sort of give a little bit of a heads up to the listeners about who Miguel is and what he's done. So as we said, you know, he is the author of a new book about Portuguese football, which is called Bring Me That Horizon, A Journey to the Soul of Portuguese Football.
That we highly recommend. Can I have that?
Yes, we do. I mean, I was reading it, over a couple of weeks and enjoyed it hugely. So good rating from me. And it's published by Pitt Publishing. We will, the details, the link to the book will be available in the show notes for anyone who's interested. But also, Miguel has published a number of other books, sporting books, including Noites Europeias, European Nights, Sueños de la Euro Dreams, and Cruyff, Anatomy of a Genius. And he's also published in Portugal, Spain, and Brazil for over a decade in a number of different publications, including Panenka, Libero, Futebol Magazine, In Bed with Maradona, and Corner. So, Miguel, again, welcome to the show. But before we start, one of the things we always like to ask guests is, do you have a team? And if so, who it is?
Yes, I have a team. It's FC Porto. I'm a club member since I was very young. And I was lucky enough to be born in 1984. That was exactly the period when Porto started to become a dominating force in Portuguese football. And I was able to enjoy a lot of that, going to the pitch since a very tender age. Seeing Porto win the Champions League, the UEFA, more than 20 leagues for a club from the second city of a country who is part of the European periphery. It's a very enthralling experience. So I think now I can live the rest of my life without seeing Porto win anything, and I would be just covered for all the things I had enjoyed until now.
Well, fantastic.
Hope it doesn't happen, at least. But yeah.
Yeah. Well, can we start off with the title of the book? What does the title mean? Bring Me That Horizon.
Well, basically, it's a tribute to the history of Portugal itself and its essence. Because it was a sentence used by sailors during the 16th, 17th centuries when Portugal became probably the nation that invented globalization. Basically, Portugal is the oldest country in the world with the terrestrial borders defined since the 13th century, that Portugal hasn't moved a single inch, because you have a neighbor like Spain, bigger, more military power, more political influence. So you're not able to expand yourself in land. Portugal had to find a way to expand by sea. So basically, they started to use their ability to hire Italian sailors and to create specific types of ships that were able to cross the Atlantic. And during those two, three centuries between 1415 and the early 1600s, basically Portugal was the dominant force in the world. And the horizon has always been something that Portuguese looked forward to. Basically, you have to look for the horizon because you have nowhere else to go. And that identity translated to the football as well, because being a country in the periphery of Europe, like I said before, limitates yourself in a very big deal. And Portuguese always have to find a strategy, a ways to corner that. And they have been able to do that, especially over the last 20 to 25 years, by having their best players play in the best leagues in the world, their managers coaching the best teams in the world, and their clubs winning trophies, and also their national side also winning the Euros. So basically, it was a sort of an homage to that identity as a nation.
Okay. Now, your book is really rich in terms of different themes that define or that influence the relationship between football and politics in the case of Portugal. Could you tell us perhaps for us listeners and people like me who are not very familiar with Portuguese football, what would you say are the theme or themes that are crucial to understand this relationship in the case of Portugal?
Well, Portugal had one of the longest serving fascist dictatorships in all the world. It lasted more than 50 years, and it shaped the country mentally, socially, and culturally. And of course, that it shaped its football as well. And Portuguese football grew up with that weight on their shoulders. And it was a fascist regime that didn't want to use football like other regimes did. For instance, in Italy, we all know how Mussolini used football a lot during his early days to create a sense of national pride and identity. We know that Spain had a very complex relationship between politics and football, but it was also an important part from the period where Franco was ruling the country. But Salazar, who was the dictator that Portugal had between the early 30s and 1972, was basically a guy like Adolf Hitler. He loathed football. He was much more into gymnastics. He hated every kind of sports that could arouse a mob. So basically, he did everything he could to prevent the evolution of the game at the same pace that was happening with other countries from Southern Europe. So basically, Portugal entered late in the stage of international football. And it was, curiously enough, one of the few things that Salazar saw that football could be of use to his regime. That was the integration of the African colonies in a period where all the African nations were starting to gain their independence from the former colonial empires, from the British, the French, the Germans, the Spanish, and to use the players born in Africa to be treated like they were Portuguese born in continental Europe, and to have the football teams in Portugal using those players, getting those players to play for the national side. It was the only thing that helped Portugal on the long run, because basically what that brought to Portuguese football was a quality they didn't have in continental Europe, a type of player that was very different. It was different physically, it was different technically, and it was different mentally. And that shaped the first golden age of Portuguese football during the 1960s, where Benfica won twice in a row the European Cup and played another three finals. Where Portugal played the semifinals of the World Cup 1966 and lost again against England. And basically, that was also a consequence of that idea to integrate the African-born players, Negroes, most of them, into the Portuguese side. And of course, if you want to talk about the importance of politics in Portuguese football, you have to mention the Cup final of 1969, because it was probably one of the most important football matches in Western Europe in terms of politics. The influence that it had on the fall of the fascist regime was huge. It was a time of change where the winds of May of 68 in France was starting to arrive late, of course, because being a fascist country with all the censorship meant that the ideas came a little bit later than in other countries of Western Europe. But basically, it planted the seed of change, that match, because it was the first time that was a public manifestation against the regime. And 5 years on, a lot of the people that were in the final of that day played in Lisbon between Benfica and Académica, was a club from Coimbra, the town where the main university of the country was located. And it was on strike during those days. Basically came together and inspired the military, who then made the coup that reinstated democracy in 1974.
Can I ask you one thing, just to follow up? Would you say that the relationship between football and politics is still as important as it was in this crucial phase in the 60s and 70s? Is that still a strong connection there?
Well, the thing is, Portuguese society is not a very political society, in a sense that there's not a very big ideological difference, like you see in countries like Spain, for instance, where there's clearly still a very marked line between the people from the right wing and people from the left wing. And so football now in Portugal became more connected with the regional differences between north and south, and a more idea between a very centralized country around Lisbon and the country that it's outside of it, which is part of the cultures and society since the 16th, 17th century, where all the wealth that came from the colonial empire of Africa, of Brazil, of India, flocked into Lisbon, but never reaches the other side of the country. So basically, football encaptures that differences today. But politically wise, there's not a very taking a standard for clubs, for players, for fans on a political level, like you see, for instance, in Germany or sometimes in Spain with certain clubs like Rayo Vallecano, for instance, who are very political in what they want to express. That doesn't happen in Portuguese
I mean,
football.
if maybe we can sort of move on from there, because what you said about the being very much concentrated around Lisbon. I mean, one of the things that comes through in the book is you write about the big three, about Benfica, Sporting, and Porto. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about these particular clubs, who they represent, how they came to be, to their relationship with politics.
Yeah, Portugal basically is a country where there is no localism in the sense of supporting a football club. So if you go to Italy, of course, you have Juventus, Inter, Milan, who has a spread wide support. If you go to Spain, you have Barcelona and Real Madrid, a little bit Atletico Madrid and Athletic Bilbao. But in Portugal, 90% at least of the population supports one of the big three. And that has a consequence on the way the identities of those clubs were shaped in time, and also conditionated the game, because without that localism, without economic support, the other clubs besides those three were never able to flourish and to present alternatives. And then it entered on a very repeated circle where the three clubs were just fighting for power against one another, sometimes allying one or two against the other, sometimes just fighting the three among themselves. And basically, each of those clubs represent different aspects of society. Now diluted, of course, because the origins of both clubs have been established on the early 20th century, and now society, as we know, has evolved, and we have representatives of all the society groups in every single club. But the identity is still there. Sporting, for instance, Sporting Portugal, who is probably going to win the league this year, is a country well rooted in nobility. It was a country funded by well-to-know men connected with the monarchy, the late monarchy period. And they always had that aristocratic view of sports, and especially of football. On the contrary, Benfica was always a very popular club, a club much more intertwined with the middle classes and the poor classes of Lisbon. And Porto also had a very idiosyncratic image of being a representative of the northern part of the country, which is more the commercial side of Portugal. So basically, the three clubs expanded in different eras, in the sense that when they were winning, they were gaining more support. And that came not only through football, but also through cycling, because during the 20s and 30s, cycling was as popular as football in Portugal. So basically, Portuguese football was reduced in the league to only eight teams that played around Lisbon, Porto, Setúbal, and Coimbra, who are all four towns that are on the coastline. So the clubs from the interior side of Portugal, from the southern part of Portugal, from the tipper north of Portugal, were able to see Porto, Benfica, and Sporting play. But they were able to see those cycling teams travel around the country on their different tours. So basically, when a cycler from each one of those clubs won a stage in a small village in the interior, probably the football team was starting to gain support there as a correlation. And basically, we can trace back to those days when Sporting had the better team in cycling, they got better support in determined areas. When it was Benfica's turn or when it's Porto's turn, they would turn around. And when we reached the 1950s, 60s, that's when the league starts to spread and starts to become more representative nationwide. The popularity of those clubs were rapidly established in areas where they never haven't even played a single match. So basically, that also made Portuguese supporter a different supporter from, let's say, a German supporter, a Dutch supporter, or a British supporter, because they pretty much prefer to support one of the big three, the big three club. That's usually a club that started with the grandfather, then goes to the father, to the son, and basically a familial link from the beginning. Then to support a local club, most of the local clubs in Portugal, when they host a match with any of the big three, and the big three team scores a goal, almost all the stadium starts to applaud. So that's a reality that's also been one of the biggest problems of Portuguese football to be able to grow. and to be more economically powerful, because in the sense that when the big three dry everything around them, they also are not able to grow themselves more than when they are.
Can I ask you one thing, Emil? So the big three are sport clubs that have other sports as well as football, I assume, right? So it's just to so they will have representatives in other sports as well, like same as happens in countries such as Spain, for example.
There's two fundamental things. They are club members' clubs, so the club belongs to the club members in every single case. Club members can vote. The club members have an important side on the governing of the club. They elect the president each 4 years, so that creates an even stronger link, because you can be a club member for a club in Lisbon but live in Porto or live north of Porto. You just go to Lisbon to see a couple of matches a year, but there's a sense of belonging being a club member. And also, like you said, each single club has at least seven or eight sports beside football, and they are very good at it, because they just don't dominate football. They dominate basketball, they dominate handball, they dominate the cycling teams, they dominate hockey. So since they win all the time in every single sport, then you have the supporters of those sports also enthralling in the same dynamics of the football supporter.
But you also, I from what I understand as well, is you have these, the big three also have their roots, spread across Portugal as well, in terms of sort of smaller, I don't know what to call them, sort of farm teams, or from which they draw their players as well, right?
It was bigger back in the day, but it was usually when a team, one of the big threes, were on the rise. The popularity they had made people create clubs that would be inspired in that team. So, for instance, there's a lot of Sportings in Portugal besides Sporting Club Portugal, which is the correct name of Sporting Lisbon. Usually, people call them Sporting Lisbon, and they are very mad at it because they are Sporting Club Portugal. But then you had a lot of Sportings. You have Sporting Braga, you have Sporting Clube Farense, you have teams that were built initially inspired by Sporting and their success. Also, Benfica has clubs who are with a similar crest, with a similar color, Porto as well. So that creates a sense also of dependence. Those clubs, when they started to expand on their geographical areas and when they started to grow, they would provide players to the feeder team, basically, and support as well. So, in a sense, that's why I said they rooted themselves in the center of football in Portugal, and their roots go very inside the land in every single aspect of the game. And now, in the present, what they are doing is installing academies throughout the country. So you have football players who are not playing for the club of their hometown, but they are directly already playing for the academy of one of the big threes. So before, back in the day, you had football players playing for a club, let's say Académico Viseu, for instance, is a club from a town in the interior. He would play there until he was getting first team football, and then he would be signed by one of the big threes. But now, since the early days, when he's 10, 11, 12, he's playing the academy of that club installed in Viseu. So directly, he's already connected with the club. And when he gets 14, 15, if he's good enough, they send him to Lisbon, they send him to Porto to play with the main club.
Well, no, that's what something I wanted to come to, because the history of Portugal as well is strongly intertwined with the broader Lusophone area, and the former colonies. You particularly referenced the African ones, earlier on in the discussion. And so, of course, two of Portugal's most f celebrated footballers amongst these, Eusébio and Cristiano Ronaldo, who both hail from this periphery. Eusébio from Mozambique, Ronaldo from the islands of Madeira. And I think actually they also came from teams that were affiliated to the big three. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit, but I'm curious if you could tell us not just about that, but also a little bit about these two personalities, their origins, and the extent to which they're sort of representative of Portuguese identity, whether they even sort of, there's a political dimension to these two figures as well.
And like you said, more than the two. For instance, Fernando Perutil still ranks as the player with the best goal average in the football history. Also was born in Angola and traveled to Lisbon to play for Sporting when he was 18. He boarded on a ship in the capital of Angola then, which was a Portuguese colony, arrived in Lisbon to do a test, and he stayed there for 12 years. And so we brought that the link together between Portugal continental and Portugal colonies in Africa. The difference is that he was white because his parents were both Portuguese born who had went to Africa to get a better opportunity in life than they had in Lisbon. The difference with Eusebio is black, of course. Although his father was Portuguese from continental Portugal, his mother was Mozambican. So he represents the mix between what is Portugal as an European nation and what is Portugal as a globalizing identity. In a sense, if you are a country that has been covering different parts of the world for, I would say, 500 years, then you have to have an icon that represents that symbiosis of what you are. You're not just the Portugal from the continental Europe. You are much more than that. And in a sense, Eusebio represents that because he has Portuguese continental European blood by his father, but he's also very African in every single way, both physically, technically, mentally, and the way he grew up in Mozambique represents that side of the former colonial empire, but also the influence that Portugal had in the world. So as a football player, he kind of represented both sides, and that's why he's still today, despite being a huge figure, of course, of Benfica, well beloved for fans of Sporting and fans of Porto, because they all see in him that representation of what Portugal as a nation really is, besides the European borders. Cristiano is a different story. Cristiano comes from Madeira, which is a small island in the Atlantic. And he also went to Lisbon to play for Sporting when he was just 12. He played on the feeder club of Sporting in the island. And then he moved, like I said, because they detected he had enough talent to be moving to Lisbon and to grow in the Sporting's academy. Madeira has, as an island, has a very particular identity. It was a very Republican ethos island, in a sense that they are very aware of the importance they always had politically wise. There was also a port where every single ship that traded between Europe, Africa, and South America mainly would usually board between Madeira or the Canary Islands. They are very close by. So they are used to have foreign influence, if it's British, French, Spanish, Italian, Portuguese, Moroccan. So they are very used to have different cultures, and that shaped the way they play, and that shaped their mentality as well. And Cristiano is from a very, very poor family, from the area, but in a way, he also has that work ethic that really made him a special player, despite all the huge talent he has. It's that work ethic that really shaped the identity of the Portuguese. Because basically, if you are from a country as small as Portugal, you really have to have work ethics if you want to have any sort of possibility in a world with superpowers who have much more capacity to impose what they really want from you. And in that sense, the Portuguese feel very well represented, especially the Portuguese who live in the diaspora, because one of the huge consequences of Salazar's regime was that during the 1960s and early 70s, more than 2 million people left Portugal to work in countries such as France, Germany, Switzerland, Luxembourg, or even Canada and the United States. And I have family who had to suffer that fate. And those people look at Cristiano Ronaldo and they are very proud that a guy from a poor family like they are was able to be crowned the best in the world. For them, is like a vindication of we are poor, but we are not worse than anyone else. So that was also a very important message that his career had throughout the Portuguese society, not only from the people who are physically in Portugal, but also from the Portuguese who live spread out the world.
Guy, as the resident half Brazilian, do you want to ask a half Brazilian question?
Yes. I mean, this is one of the so you know, as a fellow Portuguese speaker, I mean, for me, I've been listening to you talking about Portugal, the Portuguese diaspora, Portuguese people go, you know, traveling, you know, to other places in Europe, North America, and yet there's this gap we haven't addressed yet, which is the, you know, the influence of Brazil in Portugal, because of course, you know, a lot of Brazilian players, you know, came to Portugal to play. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about, what the history of that and what that's meant for Portugal and whether it's had any kind of a political, social consequences as well. I mean, the most notable one player I can think of would be Deco, who was a Brazilian but ended up playing for Portugal.
Pepe, yeah.
They are two very contemporary and great examples of that. And of course, Portugal-Brazil relationship is a very complex one because basically we can say that Portugal is the only colonizer from the old world, let's say, that has been colonized by its former colony. And the British, at least, despite of the global importance that the American had, still maintained some sort of prestige. The Spanish, although the Latin America has gained greatest relevance over the years, they still have a sense of emotional dependence to the heritage from Spain. But with Portugal, that didn't happen because basically Brazil is a continent. It's not only a country, it's absolutely huge. And Portugal is just a very small country. So imagine Portugal with their 11 million inhabitants. It's smaller than most Brazilian states. It's smaller than São Paulo. So basically, the influence that Portugal had in Brazil, despite taking all their gold in the 18th century, was very, very scarce. And also, the connection between Portuguese football and Brazilian football was very thin until the 1970s because Portugal used every resource they had from Africa. So they didn't need to buy players from Brazil. And Brazilian players didn't need to come for Portugal first because Brazilian league until the 1980s was very strong, so it was very rare to see Brazilian players abroad. And afterwards, because when they came to Europe, they were so good, they were directly going to the bigger clubs in Italy or in Spain. They didn't need to come to Portugal. That started to change during the 1980s, and basically because the change of the regime meant that the new republic wanted to open Portugal to the world. Portugal had been very closed within itself, and there was two ways to do that. It was a way of being culturally more close to the British and the American, importing television shows, lots of cinema, lots of literature. But in a country that had a high level of illiteracy, that was an issue. So basically, the authorities, what they did was start to import things from Brazil. And that started with soap operas, who are extremely popular in Brazil and became extremely popular in Portugal, then went to the music, and basically, it ended up with the football. So basically, from the 1980s onwards, Brazilian singers, Brazilian actors, and Brazilian players were the flavor of the month in Portugal, and they became the symbols of perfection of what they wanted to aspire, and that created a sort of emotional dependence. When a football club in Portugal signed a Brazilian, he was the good one. It could be worse than the players from Portugal, but just for having a Brazilian passport made him directly the better one. Also, when the Brazilian act of musical group came to Portugal, they would get the best venues because they came from Brazil. Brazilian actors were well respected in Portugal more than the Portuguese ones. The example of perfect beauty was the Brazilian women for Portuguese men. The perfect tourist destination was Brazil, of course. So that created a sort of dependence. But with time, it changed. At the same time that Brazilians started to come to live in Portugal because the economical situation in Portugal got better after they entered the EU. And the situation economically in Brazil started getting worse. So when Brazilians really started to came to live here, there was a sense of a backlash and a sense of xenophobia and racism that is very present in Portuguese society. I think it's a European issue, but in Portuguese society, it was an issue that was not discussed about because nobody came to live here. So people didn't have to face the dilemma. But over the past 20 years, it's been much a very tense relationship between Portuguese and Brazilians in Portugal and in football as well. That's why when Deco started to play for the national side, it was such a scandal because people believed that there was no need at that moment to have a Brazilian playing for the national team. 10 years prior, it would be the greatest honor bestowed to a football nation to have a Brazilian star like he was to play for a national side. But times were changing. And now we still live in that complex reality where now we have Portuguese managers coaching in Brazil and winning trophies in Brazil. So now the colonizer is a colonizer again. And that's a very complex situation. Only football can bring situations like that one.
Okay, so this is really interesting. I've got a question on sort of the role of Portugal in this football supply chain. We've had an episode a few months ago with Scott Coyne on from the Belgium Football Podcast on the role of, we spoke about the role of Belgium on in this global market of football, so to speak. And it seems to me that in a sense, with differences, Portugal and Belgium are comparable in that they are sort of second level in terms of financial might, but they're both countries that in very much in terms of talent that they express punch above their weight. But there is a sort of this sense that it's almost like a place of transition for a lot of players. Is that the case? And what does it mean in terms of, so does it have political implications? Does that mean something in terms of the relationship between politics and football, you say, Miguel?
It's definitely the same case, I believe. European periphery, which means every single league with outside the big four, big five, now has to produce the talents that eventually will go out to the bigger teams on those leagues, especially the Premier League and the Championship. The greatest difference that Portugal has to towards other European nations, such as Belgium or the Netherlands or Greece or Turkey, or even Russia, is that they are a point of connection between Europe, Africa, and South America still. So Portugal is still able to scout and to bring to the league players that come from Brazil, Colombia, Argentina, Uruguay, also African countries, better than other countries in Europe because they have been doing that for the past 40 years. So they have established already networks. They have great scouting teams, not only the big three, but other smaller clubs as well. They work with a set group of football agents, and the figure of Jorge Mendes, of course, it's impossible to speak about Portuguese football in the present, and especially within that supply chain, without speaking of Mendes, because he really controls a lot of the information flowing from those parts of the world. So Portuguese football has that upper hand.
Sorry, can I interrupt you for listeners that might be a bit less sort of familiar with it? Who is Jorge Mendes?
Jorge
Jorge
Mendes
Mendes.
is probably the most influential football agent working currently and over the past 20 years. Is the guy that really transformed the idea of a football agent. Football agents have been around for decades, but until the Bosman Law came in 1994, where players started to really own their destinies and started really to need someone to advise them financially and to advise them where they would go, because until that moment, it was only a negotiation between football clubs that allowed players to move from one side to another. But after the Bosman Law, everything changed, and football became in the hands of the players, and eventually football agents came to the rescue, and they started to grow in relevance for their careers, but also for the club's structuring. So basically, Jorge Mendes is one of the biggest in the world, and probably the most relevant over the past 2 decades. Is the agent of Cristiano Ronaldo, of course, José Mourinho, but a lot of other players, not only Portuguese. And he established a network throughout the years that has made him a current figure when you see a football match in Real Madrid Stadium, but also Manchester United, but also Bayern and Juventus. And you can see him in center stage because he's present everywhere. He has connections all around. And that was in itself a weapon that Portuguese football used in their favor, because counting was such an influential figure, made those football clubs we talked before, Porto, Benfica, Sporting, more able to produce the talent, but also be able to sell it to the highest bidder with the best possible price. Talent was being produced also in the Netherlands, also in Belgium, also in the Nordics, also in Central Europe, but they were having a tougher time to place it on the big stage. And Portugal, with Mendes and with other smaller agents that grew in his shadow, was able to not only put the local players in that market, but also persuade younger players from South America and from Africa that if they came to Portugal and spend a couple of seasons there, they will also get the possibility to be sell to the Real Madrids, to the Liverpools, the Chelseas, the Manchester Cities of life. That has changed a little bit over the years because usually Portuguese clubs were used as the middleman. You would spot an 18-year-old Brazilian potential superstar. He would sign for Porto, Benfica, or Sporting, and he would spend a couple of seasons in Portugal, play Champions League football, and some of the bigger leagues would take notice and would sign him. What we see over the past 3 to 5 years, especially with clubs already creating that multi-club culture and strategy, we see they are signing those players directly. They are not using the middleman anymore. And that will have a huge impact in the influence of Portugal in the European game, because now they are not able to go and sign the Vinicius, the Endricks, the players that are in Brazil starting, because Real Madrid got there first, or Manchester City got there first, and they are not shy to spend more money than Portuguese clubs could. And they provide those players already with the possibility of being in a bigger team. So basically, what Portuguese needs to do, Portuguese football needs to do, is to reinvent themselves. And they have done it brilliantly in a sense they are starting to look inside once again, and they're starting to give more relevance to the players that are already in the Portuguese football lower leagues, already playing on the U teams. And that's why now we have a generation of Portuguese players that are already in the best leagues in the world when they are 20, 21, 22, playing in PSG, in Barcelona, in Italy, in the Premiership, in the Bundesliga, because that's the way they have managed to stay relevant.
Yeah, we've not asked you anything regarding the national football team. Would you say that some of the trends or some of the issues that you mentioned when we talk about Portuguese football more in general are reflected in the way that the national football team is perceived? Is the national football team a symbol of a unified Portugal? Is it seen in a way as reflecting the divisions within the country and in the broader area of influence, if you want, of Portugal?
Yeah, it does. It did more in the past than it does now. Portugal national team has become a football club in itself. Basically, until the early 2000s, the national team was seen as a very proud team for Portuguese who lived abroad. There's usually when the Portuguese immigrants who live in other parts of Europe and come to spend the summer holidays in Portugal, they usually come by car. They came from France, from Switzerland, Luxembourg, and Germany, and most of them has a sticker on their cars with the national license plate or wherever they come, with the Portuguese Federation logo, not the Portuguese flag, but the Portuguese Federation logo. That's what they feel most proud of when they are abroad. Not Portugal the country, because Portugal the country has a lot of issues, and basically that's what they kicked them out or their families before them to live abroad. But the Portuguese national team brought them something to be proud of, because when they played good, when they won, they could look in the eye of the Germans, of the French, and say, we're not worse than you. But for the people who were living in Portugal, the Portuguese national team entered the Game of Thrones between the big three. So if you had a very good generation of players and you were a Benfica supporter and those players were playing through the national side, then Sporting and Porto supporters would be against the national team because they were picking players from Benfica. And you can change the name of the club, but the rivalry will still be the same. But during the last 15 to 20 years, that changed. And that changed because Portugal's national team started to field players who only play abroad, because the teams from Portugal are not able to retain the talent anymore, besides the 21, 22, 23 years of age. So usually all the good players are playing in the Premiership, are playing in La Liga, in the Bundesliga, in the Serie A. So basically, despite they have been playing in any moments of their lives for one of the big three, or are a youth product of one of the big three, they are now players from Manchester United, from Liverpool, from AC Milan, from Real Madrid. So that in itself kind of erased the internal guerrilla between the rivalries of the big three and created a new kind of supporter. A supporter of the national side as an independent club, as a fourth big club in Portugal, and especially with the younger generations who never lived the period when the national team fielded players that played in the league. They now only know those players not from seeing them live in the pitch like the previous generations, but only by seeing on the television or playing with them in the PlayStation with the FIFAs. So basically, they are more devoted to the national side because they feel they belong more to that idea of a national team than their fathers or their grandfathers, who always said that the club came first and the national side came second.
Just very quickly, I mean, what are your expectations for the Euros this year?
Well, I think Portugal has a very good chance to win the trophy. which probably means they won't, because like it happened in 2016, it was probably the worst side Portugal fielded in a competition for a long time, and they managed to win. Very similar to what happened with Denmark in 1982. Basically, Portugal was always known to play very good football, but never winning. It happened in 2084, 2004, 2012. So they have a brilliant generation of players, and I think they have more abundance now they never had. But that in itself is also an issue, because you have to create group dynamics to be successful in international sports nowadays. And to create group dynamics, you have to have like a team of 15 to 16 players who are very used to play along each other, and create those types of dynamics takes time. And the new national coach, Spanish Robert Martinez, used the past 2 years to try a lot of different players, try a lot of different strategies in the pitch. So there's not a recognizable 11 still for this generation of Portuguese football. And then, of course, it's the figure of Cristiano Ronaldo still looming there. And we saw what happened in the last World Cup, when he was already on the downside of his career, but he insisted he had to still play every single match. That created a problem within the dressing room. He didn't play the match of the last 16 against Switzerland, which Portugal won easily against Switzerland. Then he didn't play initially with the match against Morocco, and when he entered, he wasn't able to perform. But he's still a very dominant figure in Portuguese football, and his influence is huge. So it will be very hard to see a Portuguese national side play without Cristiano, if Cristiano wants to play for the national side, and he really does, because he's a man who thinks he's probably eternal and wants to keep on breaking records, which he'll probably will. But that in itself, it's an issue for the national side coach, because he has to create a group dynamics, but also a group dynamics that includes a figure that is now playing a different sport than everyone else, really, because of his age and his limitations.
Miguel, can I ask you to remind listeners the title of your book and where they can find it?
Thank you very much. And one of the main idea behind the book was that there was no book about Portuguese football written in English. So, like you said, a very influential country in football history deserved a book that tried to explain at least some of the things that we have been discussing here, and the singularities of the game. The book is called Bring Me That Horizon: A Journey to the Soul of Portuguese Football. The publisher is Pitch Publishing, and you can find it in Amazon or in every single bookstore in the UK. And if you're in continental Europe, just use the Amazon of your country, and it's available there to purchase.
Well, listen, Miguel, thank you so much for taking the time to come talk to us. We've really only just scratched the surface, because I know there's so much more in that book, and it's well worth a read. So, Miguel, thank you again for taking the time to speak.
Thank you both for having me. It was great.
And Francesco, now we need to sort of just wrap up. So, what are the usual things that we have to
Well,
say?
first of all, Miguel's book got a very good review from you, and I know you're very strict with the reviews. So 5 stars from you, it's it
Two thumbs
happens
up.
very it happens very rarely. So that should be a clear message to listeners to actually get the book. We need to remind listeners to a few things, the usual ones. Well, first of all, we need to thank them for getting in touch with us and suggesting episodes, and we have to ask them to keep doing that. They can find us everywhere. They can find us on, well, we've got a Twitter X page, football, Facebook page. We are on Blue Sky. Then they can find us individually in LinkedIn.
And we've got an
On
Instagram
LinkedIn,
account.
we got an Instagram account.
Right.
And then the other thing is to please share, like, follow, whatever system you can do on your on the platform where you're getting the podcast. Share the podcast with friends, family. And yeah, and then let's push this thing and help us doing that.
And who are we speaking to next week? What are we talking about next week, Francesco?
So it's interesting because we stay in the Lusophone area, but we talk about a completely different topic, because next week is going to be Luisa Turbino Torres, and you guys will correct my not correct Portuguese pronunciation if you want to. And the topic, it's female fans activism in Brazil. So we stay in the Lusophone area, in the Portuguese speaking area, but we change topic and country. So one really to look forward to.
Yeah, well, I'm looking forward to that. So, Great. Well, thank you, Francesco, for that. And again, thank you, Miguel, for
Thank
taking
you,
the time
Miguel.
to talk to us. And Francesco, I'll see you again next week then.